Hello, and welcome to another episode of Such Stuff, the podcast from Shakespeare's Globe. In the final episode of our series on Shakespeare and race, we'll be taking a closer look at the question that has underpinned our entire series: how do we decolonise the works of Shakespeare? Throughout this exploration of racism and the predominance of whiteness in the way we study Shakespeare, in our education system, and in our theatres, we've come back to this question again and again. Of course, like most of the questions we've posed in this series, there is no one way, no single solution. So, we asked all of our contributors from this series for their thoughts on Shakespeare and decolonisation. We'll also be sitting down again with the Globe's Head of Higher Education and Research, Professor Farah Karim Cooper, who originally conceived and curated our Shakespeare and Race Festival back in 2018, and Artistic Director Michelle Terry, who joined her as a co-curator for our 2020 Digital Festival. You heard from them right at the top of the series when we started this, and here they reflect on the festival and look forward to the future. So, first up, our wonderful Season 6 contributors. What you are about to hear is their myriad suggestions, ideas, and contributions to the question of Shakespeare and decolonisation, all, of course, informed by their perspectives and their work. In order, you'll hear from Cobna Holdbrook-Smith, Federe Holmes, Stephen Kavuma, Noor Al-Ghazaz, a student from our youth theatre, Hassana Musa, Shani Bans, Amberine Dadaboy, and Ruben Espinosa. Here they are.
If we make the distinction, like, anti-racism is, I think it's good to oppose and speak out against, or to help educate or enhance ideas about what people think it means when a black person walks in the room, or if what they think it means when someone East Asian is doing a sonnet, or, you know, that's one thing. I think the decolonization is to do with organization, structure, and traditional modes of doing things. I get the sense that we do Shakespeare in certain ways because we've done Shakespeare in certain ways.
Okay, decolonizing Shakespeare. I'm going to say there is a huge difference between making a piece of work look like it has been decolonized by making sure that you have a diversity of bodies and voices on stage and actually decolonizing. So the effect of really decolonizing is that there is nothing, there are no cliches, no tropes, no inherited readings in between that company of actors and the text. The way is clear. So Shakespeare has, over time, over centuries, been harnessed, hijacked, and bridled by powerful groups, white guys, basically. And if we are able to scrape away the barnacled centuries of associations that go with those voices, those tastes, and really come to the text clean with our identity, our heritage, our voices, our tastes, that is a radical act of decolonization. But what passes for decolonization is a visible effort to diversify the cast, to use regional accents which might not even belong to the actor, to also communicate that the actors, that the company, that the director does know what they are doing by doing things in a recognisably Shakespeare-y way. That's not decolonisation. The way between you and the audience and the play is clear of all association. You are seeing the play for the first time. That is when the play is freed from a colonial grip. That is when it is in itself speaking directly through those actors to that audience. Then it is the creation of one moment. But it's so hard to achieve because these prejudices, these ideas about how it should sound, how it should look, run deep.
I think we need to break it apart. I think we need to completely start afresh or anew. I think the problem is that a lot of these things, Chekhov, Shakespeare, the Globe, the Old Vic, the National, they've always seen as if they belong to a certain group of people. So even when you attempt to decolonize it, those groups of people will be, oh my God, why are you doing that? That's mine. So then you have to make it in a way that sits or has to include them. Well, actually, I think you just need to break it all apart and start afresh and be like, what is this? Why are we doing this play? What does this play represent? What does it mean? I've never seen Shakespeare as someone I can relate to, and I'm a playwright. And that's crazy. But because in terms of education and secondary school, primary school, then drama school, Shakespeare has always been taught as it's something that belongs to white people. It's even the way we perform Shakespeare, you know, with RP and with people acting as if they're performing in front of the Queen. And it's like, what does this text mean? Like, what is Shakespeare trying to say? Like, why are we doing this play? What does it mean? What does it relate to us here? Rather than just doing it because I like it and I think it's going to sell a lot of tickets if we put this famous actor in it. So I think we need to completely break it apart. I think with actor training, I think we need to look at why we do Shakespeare in drama school. Why is that necessary? And what does it do for the actor going out of drama school? Why are we training them? I think there needs to be a real, like, radical look at actor training and who it really kind of fits and suits. I think we sort of know those answers. We know it suits white people. We know it's catered for them because the way they perform it or because the way it's been told. You know, when you look at the Globe was sort of this space that was like, you know, working class people. It wasn't for the middle class, the elite. You know, Shakespeare didn't write like that. In the sense that we're doing Shakespeare like that and we're constantly being told, this is who Shakespeare is. This is how Shakespeare should be performed. This is the history. We're constantly being told that Shakespeare is not for you, you know. So even decolonizing it, I don't think it works, really. I think we need to look at Shakespeare as if Shakespeare is a unknown playwright in order to do Shakespeare properly. The fact that this man sort of represents our culture is wrong. You know, he doesn't.
How do you think we can decolonize the works of Shakespeare? This is such an important question. We've reached a moment in history where our streets are literally being decolonized. After the heinous murder of George Floyd and the global reckoning that followed, the Black Lives Matter movement and its worldwide allyship has outrightly stated no more lies in our history books. We know the majesty of our African history. We know the truth. And so the statues and monuments of slavers and colonizers have been pulled off of their plinths all over the world. So essentially, how do we relocate this same sentiment into Shakespeare studies? And I think there's a few things we can do. The first is more color-conscious casting in productions of Shakespeare. Ayanna Thompson talks so much about this in her research. Number two, publishing, promoting, teaching, and citing scholars of color. You know, the works of Amberine Dadaboy, Kim Hall, Ayanna Thompson, Arthur Little, Leti Garcia, Ruben Espinosa, Dennis Britton, Farah Kareem Cooper, the list goes on and on and on. Their work must be at the forefront of Shakespearean scholarship in and out of the classroom. Number three, more inclusive and diverse conferences, symposiums, lectures, networks. Finally, I think we need to normalize conversations about race, conversations about blackness, conversations about whiteness and everything in between. And to do that, we must arm students at all levels with racial literacy and a racial vocabulary that these same scholars of color have been talking about for decades, essentially, in order to be able to have these really heavy conversations about race.
I think that in schools and whenever learning about Shakespeare, students should be asked to consider race and whether they see themselves represented in his works. And if so, do they view that representation as a fair portrayal?
I think decolonization in general has a lot to do with organizations of power and addressing imbalances of power in society and lingering privileges that exist in groups of society we can reread adaptations with an attention to the way Shakespeare was performed and circulated in European colonies, to think about how these texts work their way into these societies, who performed them, who read them, who dominated these narratives, and who was interested in these texts, and why, how these texts functioned in these groups, whether it was different for the colonizer and the colonized. But I also think decolonizing Shakespeare can become an important tool or means for setting in motion large-scale decolonization of English literary studies at large, and eventually even the arts and humanities. Because when a cultural institution like Shakespeare is decolonized, I think it sets the tone for decolonization, and I think the effects of this will reverberate into other aspects of knowledge-making in society. So in a tangible way, this can sort of take the form of organizing and attending anti-racist workshops among Shakespeare scholars, and maybe reevaluating the way Shakespeare is organized in course curriculums. So this could take the shape of positioning Shakespeare in concept-based courses that center around literature of empire or race, rather than trying to slot race into a course on Shakespeare. And I think these kinds of structural changes could be easily implemented into other aspects of English studies. I think Shakespeare scholars and readers, and maybe even directors and performers, might also find great benefit in working through interdisciplinary channels to also come up with creative educational solutions to make some of these histories and important concepts of colonialism, slavery, racism, gender discrimination available to people where this material hasn't been made available before. So reading Shakespeare through this history might become an entry point for these conversations. Finally, I think it's really important to dissolve Shakespeare's high cultural identity as a part of this process, and to think about how accessible Shakespeare is to people from various backgrounds, whether this happens through things like free festivals or setting up interactive performances or writing communities that maybe invite people to translate Shakespeare into their own dialects and lingo, things that make Shakespeare accessible and spread his ownership amongst people. And I think this will lead to a renegotiation or a reevaluation of Shakespeare's relationship to power, which ultimately needs to change in order for some kind of decolonization to occur.
I think it's a very difficult thing, because I think we're all very eager to decolonize the works of Shakespeare. I think developing the tools to have difficult discussions on race with students, discussions that are uncomfortable, building that trust and creating a safe space in which to have those conversations, and then also on top of that having sort of a racial literacy in the classroom, by which I mean, you know, people having read enough or being taught about how to talk about race in a way that's not offensive, but in a way that's also people aren't hesitant to speak because they fear they might offend, to be able to speak openly, comfortably, safely within the classroom. And I think one way to do that in part of the teaching is, and this is a huge point in how do we decolonize the works of Shakespeare, is we have to hire more scholars of colour. If a scholar of colour is in the room, a teacher of colour is in the room with the students talking about these difficult discussions, then that adds some kind of level of comfortability to the students of colour. And I think there's certain things that can be done or addressed. For example, just a very simple one, the hiring process itself has questions sometimes in any field. Will this person be a fit for our department? And that question itself carries racial biases. I think every department should make a conscious effort to look at the questions that they ask their interviewee, but to also have more people of colour in the room, in the interviewing stages. Having a diverse panel will help. Lastly, I think this issue comes down quite bluntly to the issue of money and funding. We're talking about pipelines and getting graduates into programmes. That diversity will only come if there is an investment financially in students of colour pursuing further studies, pursuing MAs, MAs being funded. I worked 4 jobs during my master's to the point that I was very close to dropping out, and I took alone. And so there's a lot of reasons why graduates won't apply to do Shakespeare or to do an MA. We have to think about how do we get students of colour into the discipline and into the room. And then when you do get your foot in the door, I think waiving registration fees for conferences, I think at the moment during the pandemic has been quite interesting, because if most conferences and talks are virtual, it's sort of evened out that playing field of being able to access and attend and be in the virtual spaces. The very predominantly white spaces have now become virtual spaces, which I think is a good thing.
I don't know if we can decolonize Shakespeare, because Shakespeare is at the center of a colonizing curriculum, right? If we think about Macaulay and we think about the point of education in India for the British Empire and to turn these natives into civilized subjects, and the fact that we use Shakespeare, or Shakespeare was used, I'm not the we in here, right? The fact that these people used Shakespeare to do that, then it already is implicated in colonial and imperial methodologies and violences. I don't think we can decolonize Shakespeare. I think we can, again, be attentive to the imperial histories and trajectories of Shakespeare. And to be attentive in that way means that we recognize how Shakespeare has been used and how these texts are malleable in this way, and maybe use the logics of these own texts to challenge those relations of power and domination. Sort of those efforts come through, again, having a professoriate that is not all white. It comes through performance tradition that is attentive to race and color conscious, and really bringing through our histories as people who might have suffered under empire in how we interact with Shakespeare.
People of color, certainly people, black and brown individuals, feeling a sense of ownership over Shakespeare, that he is part of their legacy. And if they do feel that not only do they have access to Shakespeare, but legitimate views of Shakespeare that have something meaningful to offer, then that's half the battle. That's understanding the oppressive structures that have defined them and turning that and thinking about Shakespeare in a different way. And so many of my students have done that. You know, I have one assignment where I have them do iMovie productions, 5 minutes, an adaptation of any scene from Shakespeare that we study. The only caveat is that they have to speak to a contemporary, preferably regional social issue. And in those moments, it's wonderful to allow the students to see, like, yes, I not only can do this, but understand it in a meaningful way. And that in and of itself here, I think, creates hopefully opportunities for the students to see that this stems way beyond Shakespeare here, right? And way beyond that particular class into their everyday lived experiences. That, for me, to decenter Shakespeare from this kind of white academy, to decenter Shakespeare from, you know, what we've been told Shakespeare is, to question the gatekeeping of Shakespeare, and as many have done before, but really allowing students to question that gatekeeping of Shakespeare too, then allows for us to think about all the ways that gatekeeping works. And they arrive at these conclusions by themselves, which is as good as it gets.
Of course, we could talk for hours on the subject of Shakespeare, race, and decolonization. But how do we put the ideas, the thoughts, the learnings from both this podcast series and our Digital Shakespeare and Race Festival into action? Here's Michelle and Farah reflecting on the Shakespeare and Race Festival and discussing what next for making decolonization a reality at Shakespeare's Globe and beyond.
I mean, maybe the first thing to ask is, having done this work for such a long time, how was the festival for you? That's the first question. And then now I've said that, I sort of go, the second question is, do you feel like the conversation is progressing in the time that you've been doing this work? Do you feel like we're moving the conversation forward, both in a society, in education, in our own organisation? Starter for 10.
I think for me, the festival I was anxious about it because it was all online. As a creature who likes to talk to people in person and to get a sense of how people are feeling in the room when they're hearing conversations, that at first made me anxious. But actually being able to reach a wider audience and being able to reach people in lots of different countries, that makes a big difference. It feels like if we're just talking in a bubble in a room at Shakespeare's Globe, how far-reaching is that conversation really? You know, when we go back to on-site work, it would be great to maintain that sort of digital connection so that we can keep those conversations up on a broader basis. In terms of the conversation, I think what's really exciting but scary is that we're having these conversations in a time of precarity because we don't know what the future for theater is, and we're hopeful about theater and higher education, and people of color in those institutions are more at risk now than they have been ever before in some ways. So there's a lot of precarity around the conversation. So it feels like we have to hold on even tighter and work even harder at this moment. What about you?
I suppose that's the big thing for me now is exactly as you said, how do we maintain reach with these conversations? Because it's happening within rooms. And if the conversation doesn't extend beyond those rooms and we don't know that each other is having those conversations, how are we joining up those dots? If throughout the series, people have talked about societal change, cultural change. As you say, if we're speaking in a vacuum, if we're preaching to the converted, where are those conversations going? So I think that is the big thing from this time has given us, is those conversations can extend beyond. There is huge comfort that in some of the things that people are saying, as an organisation, we can hand on heart say, we are doing that work, we are digging deeper, it's not just optics, it's not just lip service, it's not just a nice statement to say in solidarity with. There is huge rigour. We're in action with it. It's not just theoretical, we are in action. But the amount of people that don't know, and people don't know that we're doing this work, there are other organisations doing similar work. So how do we unite those conversations? And then the precarious nature of the time. I think in one of the podcasts, maybe it was Stephen Kavuma talking about, you know, theatre will be all right. Theatre's not going to go anywhere. It's just what happens when we come out the other side of it. Who is making the theatre? Who is having the conversations? Who is leading the conversations? And on one hand, I think we all sort of recognise, yes, it is precarious. Yes, this is profoundly difficult. But where in there, and I know, and I don't mean opportunity in any glib way, but this is one of the greatest opportunities we've been given to reassess those power structures. Where does the power sit? And how do you decentralise power? How do you create spaces where everybody walks into the room and feels like their voice will be heard? I think you said, you know, it will take decades. Well, it already has taken decades. This is not the beginning of a conversation. Not only to give up power, and again, I don't think it's necessarily people having to give up power. That's one way. And then there's also another way where there is room for everybody. But how do you make room for everybody? And then also, and I say this to you as a woman of colour, I say this as a woman, how do you take power when space is made for you? Like, it's no good saying to people, well, you've got a voice now, what have you got to say? If you're not used to speaking. And then when you get those moments of being able to speak or moments of being able to shift the power, how do you hold on to that? Because the default, those hierarchical structures, those centralised, white, essentially male positions of superiority, they're recognisable at a time when nothing is recognisable and we're all frightened.
Yeah, I think you pose a really good question about how do you take the power and what do you do with it? I still don't feel I'm in a position where the door is being held open yet. And so I'm still kind of thinking, well, I have to keep using my voice and I'm going to use the platforms that I've been given. That's my version of taking the power, because the power really just sits with being able to speak and recognize that there are structural issues in your own organization and your own industry and your sector. And I've been kind of shouting about those now. And it could be with great risk to myself, because people may not want to work with me after this. I'm hoping that's not the case. But taking power is still like a process. And it's not about like taking power. It's about just, you know, sitting in the rooms where decisions and policies are made. It is really important to have representation in those rooms. And at the moment, there are way too many of those rooms that are homogenous. And I just think that's unacceptable now. And I can't work in a world in which we recover from this pandemic and we're still operating in those homogenous contexts. I've gotten to the age now where I feel I just don't want to work in that situation anymore. And I think everyone is starting to feel that way.
Yeah. Again, one of the gifts of the time is the room can be really big now. The room doesn't have to be, oh, we've only got six chairs to go around the table, so that means the executive team can only be made up of six people. You can have really big Zoom rooms. Like, how can we use how do we use that to...
And also, what about rotational structures of leadership where, you know, a bit like government or some governments, we hope, where you have a few years to do the work that you want to do and then you rotate off and you create a structure where you still have a level of consistency and institutional knowledge. That way you kind of ensure there's going to be representation at some point and hopefully sooner than later.
Well, and that's, you know, how long should a tenure be? What is enough time for someone to come in, hopefully do good and then go again? But my fear is still, who's applying? Because you could only give jobs to the people that apply. I still worry that we've not quite shifted the dial enough that people go, that's absolutely somewhere, a place that, I mean, we're talking specifically about leadership roles now, aren't we, I suppose? Like those people that can actually, that have the power to make change.
There's still a lot of work to do in the pipeline, though, isn't there? I guess as an organization, as an iconic Shakespeare organization, I feel committed. I hope we will commit to influencing those pipelines, right? What work can we do at schools, at universities, in drama schools to sort of change the game so that in a decade you find we're just not having to have this conversation anymore? That's part of the problem. So it's not just the leadership, is it? It's getting into the game in the first place and feeling like it's a space for you.
Yes. I think the thing that was being thread through the series was this idea of decolonizing Shakespeare. And I think the more that I've listened and the more that we've discussed stuff, Shakespeare, like the words, and I still say this with all the understanding that it comes of my own sort of legacy of this white supremacist view of it, I still think the art is miraculous because I think it will bend and flex to whoever is doing it. But my big fear is exactly who is in the room, who is taking up the space, who feels like it can be for them. And so it's less about needing to decolonize Shakespeare, it's decolonizing all the things that lead you to Shakespeare, decolonizing the rooms, the rehearsal rooms, the lecture halls, the seminars, the pipeline or the process or whatever that is. Because if you have diversity in the room, Shakespeare will bend and flex. How do we allow for that alchemy of the people in the room having autonomy, having power to make empowered choices that speak to them rather than feeling like there's already a predestined answer? And then the big thing, I suppose, I don't know whether this speaks to higher ed as well, there's this big mass that is our audience. I think in one of the podcasts someone says society is always reproducing itself. How do you change the conversation even around going to a play? Because if all you're doing actually, regardless of what is happening on stage, regardless of the rigour in the room, regardless of the complexity of the conversations, the decolonising of the text, if society is only going to reproduce itself, you have an audience that is only going to reproduce a white-centric narrative. So how are we also taking our audience on a journey or our students on a journey?
A lot of it is the performance history of Shakespeare, 400 years of seeing Shakespeare performed in a particular way. And granted, there are so many different kinds of performance models, but there's one that emerges the most prominently, particularly in this country, which is that Shakespeare is spoken with received pronunciation. it's cast in a way that makes sense to people, you know, and there is a kind of elitism that is attached to that, that people struggle with, feeling like that belongs to them or that has anything to do with them. And the way some artists respond, as you know, is, well, we're going to do it this way. And it's marvelous. But I think it's still something that's intimidating. So it's a kind of gatekeeping, is that perception of what performance is. And I suppose in the way it's taught at school, there's so many gatekeeping signals all the way through to university, to PhD, to early career researcher, to senior lecturer, where, you know, you can't get an article published because you've written about race, and you look at the editorial board and it turns out there isn't a single person of color on that editorial board. Or if there is, they haven't been consulted about that essay. And so it's breaking that down as well, so that people actually recognize that Shakespeare is utterly capacious and elastic. And you know that. And you've had to work elastically with the texts as a woman.
You know, we're in a supply and demand industry. If I think about theatre, it's our job to give people what we think they want. Can theatre also start to move into an arena where, and it's not a new idea, but where the audience is in conversation with the material? It doesn't necessarily have to think that the production is perfect or good or iconic or definitive. And again, this is not new. This is what the Globe has given us. Like, you know, these groundlings were absolutely in conversation with the play. I feel like the plays have always been demanding more. Conversation, imperfection, gaps, questions without answers absolutely infuse these plays. And somehow the death of them is demanding them to provide answers. How do we redefine the terms of what is satisfying? How do we redefine the terms of what is successful? Like, I think someone talked about, you know, this idea that the minute you see someone of colour on stage, or the minute you see a woman on stage, somehow it's lesser. But I also feel like we underestimate our audience. You know, when you think of what people are consuming right now, there is an insatiable desire for learning and for knowledge. People do want to understand. And what worries me is that when I think of how brave people have been during this festival, when I think about how brave artists have been doing the work on the front line of complexity, it's a really big ask of people to come and be that vulnerable. As you've just said, like, it's a risk for you saying what you say. There's no guarantee that you're going to come out the other side of this and people will have understood what you're trying to do. We have a global platform. We're called the Globe, and to take that platform and trust that there will be compassion and understanding to realise that this is about moving a conversation on, rather than feeling like you're the pressure of having an answer.
I mean, I completely agree. I think there are some people who don't want to find themselves in that vulnerable position because they have before and have been seriously burned. And yes, I think it is a risk. And how hard is it to come and do a panel on race when you are a person of color and then go home with the thoughts that have been generated by that conversation, knowing that that is your lived experience and that there isn't a solution right around the corner, and that the powers that be are just starting to have conversations that you have lived since you were a child. So there's a lot of emotional labor that goes into this. And I think that is being more and more recognized now. And I feel really positive, actually, about the conversations we're hosting, because they come from a place where we are genuinely needing and wanting to change things. There's privilege there, isn't there? Like, you can engage with race if you want to. If you have the bandwidth that day and you want to listen to some difficult conversations, you can engage with it. But there are those of us who have to engage with it on a daily basis, and we don't have a choice to just duck out.
Yeah, the work it will take to really change. And again, like, it's generational. Yes, as we've talked about, the hope is that we leave behind policies that embed change into the organisation. But if we're to break that cycle of homogeneity, That means for a while we're asking people to continue to put themselves at risk because we can't guarantee. There's great will, but we can't guarantee yet that the work has been done. It's such a precarious time that if we're going to make true generational shift where, when I jog on, the hope is the people on that list is way more diverse than it was when I applied 2 years ago, or that when you move on, that this work doesn't go with you. It can't be about people. It has to be about policy. It's got to be beyond personal principles now.
Do you think that it scares people, this notion of decolonizing Shakespeare, that is a very frightening concept because people don't necessarily understand what that means, or they have different understanding of what that means, even though it's kind of flexible in terms of what that means? You know, all of our contributors to the podcast that were asked that question all had a different response to the question, which means that there are multiple angles. Decolonizing Shakespeare does not mean denying people Shakespeare. It does not mean changing the words necessarily, or not telling the stories anymore. And I think that's what people fear. They're scared that it's going to turn into something that they don't recognize, which it might, but it's still Shakespeare.
I think everything scares people at the moment. But the idea that Shakespeare is not going to be something that people recognize, Shakespeare is always unrecognizable. Always. Like, as someone that lives with these plays, have performed some of them 3 or 4 times, it's never the same play twice, because I'm never the same person twice. So somewhere in there, it is about emancipation and liberation. It is liberating for everybody to not feel like there is a right or white way of seeing Shakespeare. I mean, it does go back to that James Baldwin quote, that we're not responsible to the poet. Poets are responsible to us. Poets are responsible to the society. If this work is going to live for another 400 years, it's because he's always responsible to the people. It's just which people. It was lots of white men. Then it sort of branched out a bit. Then women found a place, but it was predominantly white women. Now we're finding that it is diversifying, but still it's really hard to break the lie or the myth that there is a right way of reading Shakespeare. I mean, again, you know better than me the education system, but the idea that you could put a right answer in an essay, the idea that there's a, you know, sort of box Shakespeare up into something definitive, that's the death knell of it, as opposed to going, there is no definitive. We don't even know who Shakespeare is. It doesn't matter who Shakespeare is. When we say, like, Shakespeare for all, or it's so universal, that's a whitewashed idea of universal. That's the white male version, but it's idealized. It has nothing to do with the work at all. That's the colonization that we have to decolonize.
I mean, what's interesting, I totally agree. I think what we were doing in Behind Closed Doors, for example, is really coming to grips with the language in Shakespeare that hurts, that's harmful, and how it feels as a person of color to say some of those lines. That is a form of decolonizing Shakespeare by saying, look, we've often ignored these or been okay with these for several hundred years now. We're not okay with this language anymore. So let's try and work out why that is, and what is Shakespeare's part in sort of racist textures that we can see coming from the period. I think that's really valuable, really hard work. And directors and actors in a rehearsal room have so much talking to do about what those words can do for their production, or what they take away from the actor's humanity. And I think, you know, enabling flexibility in rehearsal rooms like that is what decolonizing Shakespeare means in some ways.
It's also then making sure, A, the actors have been empowered. Like, there is a centralized power that usually sits with the director. How do you make sure that actors are empowered, so that when those actors are out there, you know, as an audience, you know those actors are not just doing what they've been told or having to do things because conversations didn't happen. They are owned choices, and that we endow those actors with that power and that autonomy to make them. If you're coming to this work, are you coming because it's a nice thing to do and that's great, or are you coming as an activist? And if you're coming as an activist, you have to know that too, and that there's work to that, and there's a fallout to that. And as an organisation, we have to know what we're asking of people, so that we can put, to use your word, scaffolding around it. Because of course, there is a place for people to just say nice words in nice costumes, in nice weather during the summer. Sure. I'm all for entertainment, like, great. And then there is something, I mean, for me, Shakespeare's work is also always political. Like, I think he's a political writer.
Yeah, because if there's people on stage that don't feel empowered, then it's not entertainment anymore for everybody.
Exactly, exactly. But somehow we have to have much more honest conversations about what is the transaction that we're asking all of us to engage in. Each project needs to be taken care of, whether that's a workshop, whether that's a lecture, whether that's the production. Everything needs to be given its own time and its own space and its own bespoke needs. We have this conveyor belt of production. And somehow, again, I think it was Stephen Kovima said, how do you press pause on the whole thing and almost start again? I think it is about every single step that you make. A, who is making the choices? Who is rocking the boat? Who's doing the leading? Where does power sit? And every time an invitation is made or a project is made, how are you making sure that the scaffold is really bespoke to the needs of it? That's a huge amount of work.
Well, let's get on with it then.
Yeah, exactly.
It is so much work, but I think that we genuinely want to do it, and the Globe has committed itself to doing that work now, so we have to see how that works across the transition period from pandemic to post-pandemic.
Onwards we go.
To bring our Shakespeare and Race series to a fitting close, we wanted to bring you something special. Here is festival co-curator Cobner Holdbrook-Smith reading James Baldwin's Why I Stopped Hating Shakespeare.
The greatest poet in the English language found his poetry where poetry is found, in the lives of people. He could have done this only through love. By knowing, which is not the same thing as understanding, that whatever was happening to anyone was happening to him. It is said that his time was easier than ours, but I doubt it. No time can be easy if one is living through it. I think it is simply that he walked his streets and saw them and tried not to lie about what he saw. His public streets and his private streets, which are always so mysteriously and inexorably connected. But he trusted that connection. Only he saw, as I think we must, that the people who produce the poet are not responsible to him. He is responsible to them. That is why he is called a poet. And his responsibility, which is also his joy and his strength and his life, is to defeat all labels and complicate all battles by insisting on the human riddle, to bear witness, as long as breath is in him, to that mighty, unnameable, transfiguring force which lives in the soul of man, and to aspire to do his work so well that when the breath has left him, the people, all people, who search in the rubble for a sign or a witness, will be able to find him there.
That's it from us, but we'll be back soon with another series of Such Stuff. Keep an eye on social media as we announce what's coming your way. You've been listening to Such Stuff with me, Imogen Greenberg, Michelle Terry, and Professor Farah Karim Cooper. To find out more about Shakespeare's Globe, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'll be back soon with more stories from Shakespeare's Globe, so subscribe wherever you get this podcast from.